Thank you very much indeed. Firstly, I want to thank Rotary for inviting me to give the talk there. So it's always one of the problems with trauma psychologists is the fact that we see trauma everywhere. And that's because trauma is everywhere. What I really want to sort of focus on is a more global perspective of why trauma capacity building is really so critical and so essential. Because one of the things that we know about trauma is the fact that it actually exists in every single country in the world. But when we take a country like Australia or the United Kingdom or Germany or the United States or Italy, these are countries that are very fortunate to have very, very established mental health professionals that are often very, very well trained in working with trauma. But lots of the countries that we're involved in are countries that have very, very high trauma populations, but don't necessarily have the mental health infrastructure in place in order to deal with this. The other thing, I suppose, that relates to life and very much in my role as a trauma psychologist is the fact that you meet people that change you, because the nature of their story is just so profound, really, in that sense. And so I do want to just briefly tell you something about Khartoum, who is a 16-year-old girl that I met in an IDP camp, an internally displaced populations camp in northern Iraq in 2015. This is a woman who is a Yazidi, and the Yazidi were deliberately targeted by Islamic State. They captured young boys who they wanted to indoctrinate into becoming soldiers. But they also captured young women with the intention of converting them into sex slaves. And one of the things Pam said before about my research being in the issue of sexual abuse within the church, and one of the things that struck me is that there was an incredible similarity between this research and some of the findings that we were picking up in northern Iraq, in terms of the fact that people's religion were actually being used against them as a means of torture. So the scenario that they faced was they were given a choice. You either convert to Islam and you will be married to one jihadist, or you keep your faith and you will then be passed from jihadist to jihadist to jihadist. You know, and so these young women had to make these terrible, terrible choices. And some of these were repeatedly sold by jihadists for as little as a packet of cigarettes. And sometimes they were sold from day to day, really, you know, in this sense. But one of the things that struck me about Khartoum's story was that there were parts of the narrative that she was willing to share, and there were other parts that she was not. And from a trauma psychology perspective, that creates an important dilemma for us, because how do we work with this? How do we work with a survivor who is not able to tell us a critical part of their story? And you'll see a bit later on that there are often two reasons why people don't do this. One is the fact that the trauma induces very, very high levels of shame, as if in some way it generates a feeling of self-defectiveness. But the second one is a genuine fear of retribution, that this is something that they feel that if they tell the story, that not only their lives will be in danger, but those of their family and loved ones will be in danger. Now, most trauma treatments actually involve some form of exposure. But it's very hard to do exposure treatment if the client is not able to then tell the narrative. And this is where I think a very important trauma treatment of EMDR therapy can have a significant part to play in relation to this, really. So you'll see the fact that the Yazidi population, when you talk to them about genocide, and as you know, genocide is an act that involves some form of a major organizational system, usually by governments or usually by military. But the attack on the Yazidi was planned meticulously. It was a military operation in many respects. But the Yazidi, which is a very, very old religion, they've been subjected to over 70 acts of genocide in the course of their history. When we've interviewed many of the survivors of ISIS, what we find is the fact that they've got lots of narratives, and the many of the behaviors that they were subjected to were profoundly dehumanizing, and these are things sadly we've seen in many other sort of acts of genocide, really, in that sense. Now, as a consequence of the work in Iraq and other countries, one of the things that you may be aware of, but the United Nations does not really have a specific focus on trauma. Some are very critical of the UN for the fact that it doesn't have sufficient impact on mental health, let alone trauma. But one of the other agencies that doesn't really consider trauma as an issue is the World Bank. And we've been negotiating with the World Bank for several years now to try and get them to have more of a trauma focus in their interventions. Now, you will know that Islamic State took over a part of the Philippines last year in the island of Mindanao in Marawi. And on behalf of the World Bank, we were asked to go in and do a trauma assessment. Now, let me just sort of explain to you these two pictures. But you'll see here that this is the city of Marawi, which is where Islamic State sort of captured this region from May to October of last year. But you'll see that this city is completely and utterly devastated. There is so all of the population that lived in this city have now been displaced throughout the island and are now living in IDP camps. And you'll see the fact that if the whole city is like this, they're never going to be able to go back to their homes sort of anytime soon. But I want to just very briefly tell you the story about this person here. This person is a Roman Catholic priest, Father Chito. And this is the cathedral, the Roman Catholic cathedral, that is right in the middle of Marawi, right in the middle of this Islamic city. And when ISIS first attacked the city, his first responsibility was to get to the cathedral and to protect it. But subsequently, he was then immediately captured by Islamic State, and he was actually held hostage for 116 days. And you'll see the level of destruction in the cathedral, where you know, any religious artifact has just been completely destroyed and sort of desecrated. Now, Father Chito came for treatment, and one of the treatments that we used was EMDR therapy, because what he particularly wanted to do is he wanted to go back to his church community. He wanted to go back to the cathedral. And the only way that we were able to do that is with the help of the military. So as you'll see here, this was the day that we were actually able to get him back into ground zero. Now, when we're talking about trauma in a medical sort of diagnostic term, we're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, interestingly, if I was to say to you which country in the world has the highest prevalence of PTSD, you might be surprised to know that it's actually Northern Ireland. But that's because that's data that we have. There's lots of countries where we don't have data on a national level. And so So you'll see here the fact that actually from the studies that we're doing at the moment in northern Iraq, you'll see that the prevalence of PTSD is actually running at around about 60% of the population, which is no surprise when you think about the devastating trauma the country is actually sort of being through. The World Health Organization did a very, very thorough meta-analysis back in 2013. And what this meta-analysis did, it made it very, very clear that the most effective trauma treatments for PTSD is cognitive behavioral therapy with a trauma focus and EMDR therapy. Now, what's surprising about this WHO guideline is not only the fact that lots of people still don't know about it, but actually the fact that lots of people with PTSD are still denied those two treatments, even though we know that there is an abundant amount of empirical evidence that support the fact that these two interventions are particularly effective. So if we look at this in terms of brain imagery, you'll see here that on the left-hand side that this is a woman who had been involved in a very serious road traffic collision, and she has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And the protocol is the fact that she's put into a brain scan. As you know, brain scans are very, very noisy. And the protocol is that she's asked to tell the story of the road traffic accident. Now, what this red area here, this is measuring molecular movements. It's actually measuring oxygen flow in the brain. And you'll see the fact that actually the brain is using a huge amount of energy in order to recreate this trauma memory. So you'll see lots of activation around here, which is the cerebellum, the visuospatial cortex up in the parietal and temporal lobes. And this is the limbic system. So bringing to mind this trauma memory, the brain is using a huge amount of energy in order to do this. And really what the research shows is the fact that the best treatments for this are actually psychological treatments. And this is where cognitive behavioral therapy with the trauma focus is effective, and this is where EMDR therapy is effective. And so in this case, this is a woman who's been treated with EMDR therapy. And at the end of treatment, she's then put into a brain scan. She's then asked to tell the stories. And so you'll see much less activation here, some activity around the cerebellum, around the visuospatial cortex here, and some emotional acknowledgement, but a complete change. And so, you know, every time I look at this slide, I always find it absolutely incredible, the fact that actually a psychological treatment can bring about that neurobiological effect. You know, and in neurobiological terms, this is neuroplasticity. It's the brain's ability to rewire itself after a traumatic experience, really. And so, one of the areas within trauma that I'm very interested in, it relates to what happens when we have clients who are traumatized by experiences and they're not able to tell us, either because of shame or because of retribution. And so one of the projects that we ran in northern Iraq is to introduce an adaptation of EMDR therapy known as the blind to therapist protocol. And this is where we're getting the person to work on their trauma without them telling us what the trauma is. Actually, all we need to know is the memory active in your mind? Is the memory active in your brain? Now, the reason why technically we call this a quasi-experimental study is because we would never have got ethical approval to have done this study with the Yazidi population, and neither would we have wanted to. But we are training, and do lots of extensive trainings in Iraq, by psychologists and psychotherapists. But these psychologists and psychotherapists have also a highly traumatized population because they've been subjected to 20 years of oppression by Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist sort of regime. So during the research project, we used the blind to therapist protocol, and then at the end of treatment, we then asked them, would you be willing to just give me one word or two words to just say what your trauma memory was or what your trauma experience was? Now, bearing in mind, these are therapists, but these were the issues that they were working on. So some of them had been sexually assaulted and raped. Some of them had witnessed murders. Some of them had witnessed war-related conflicts. Several of them had been imprisoned. Several had been subjected to torture. And several of them were experiencing either historical gender-based violence or current gender-based violence. Now, from a post-traumatic stress disorder perspective, criterion A being that you have to be exposed to a trauma that actually threatens you in some way. And so what you'll see that even within the population of people that are actually providing the help, that these are also a highly traumatized population. So when we go into countries with trauma in trauma capacity building, it's not just actually thinking about the client group that you want to empower with trauma treatment. You also have to take care of the people who are actually providing the help and support. And this is where some of the principles around psychological second aid becomes very, very important in terms of supporting people. So as most psychologists doing research, I've always got to show you some research data. But what this data really shows is the fact that we were able to assess 89 sessions of using sort of standard EMDR therapy with 91 sessions where we're using the blind to therapist protocol. Because what we wanted to show in theater, in Iraq, that this was safe, that this was effective, and the fact that this was actually efficient. Now I only got back from Iraq about 2 weeks ago, and so was actually able to get the 6 month sort of follow-up data really. But you'll see here the fact that actually, that not only is there a treatment effect with using standard EMDR therapy, but you'll also see a treatment effect with actually using the blind to therapist protocol. And one of the most significant things that the research showed is the fact that these therapists that we've trained quite extensively, we've also offered treatment, that these are now carrying out intensive treatment with Iraqi populations and actually finding that exactly the same treatment effect. And one of the foundations that we work with is a foundation called the Jian Foundation for Human Rights and Torture. And what they're saying is about, on average, 40% of their clients are not willing to disclose what their trauma experiences are. And what they said historically is the fact that was there for 40% of clients that they were not able to treat. And now, with this approach, they're now able to do this. And the final thought I'll leave you with is the fact that what the research has shown is quite a remarkable fact, is that once you process the trauma memory and you shift it from trauma memory to narrative memory, which means that the level of disturbance comes down, clients eventually disclose. They disclose their experiences. So there's a correlation effect between the high levels of trauma and the high levels of shame, or the high levels of trauma and the high levels of fear and sort of retribution, really, in that sense. And so so EMDR therapy is a very valid, empirically based treatment. It does sit alongside very good treatments like prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy. But when we're working with lots of shame-based traumas, particularly around gender-based violence or societies where there's high levels of fear or retribution, then actually EMDR therapy can play a significant impact in relation to, in terms of as a trauma intervention.
Well, I'm aware that we are being recorded for a podcast. So, a disclaimer, everything I'm going to share are my own accounts. So, if you are going to quote me as me personally. Do not quote me as a Muslim or a Jordanian or a Rotarian or an Australian or someone who works in humanitarian aid. Quote me as I am. I would like to thank Steph to begin with, the Rotary Club of Melbourne, and the Treasury Building. But most, I would like to thank the custodians of this land for allowing us to meet here. And highly thank for the... ancestors, elders, past and present, for allowing us to meet here. So in brief, I worked for 8 years in international humanitarian development with the United States Agency for International Development, the EU, and other American organizations back in Jordan, where I come from. During my work, I was working other in projects that are violence against women, gender equality, human rights, youth development. My last assignment was a logistics manager in refugees camps in Syria, but I was based in Turkey. Growing up in Jordan, you get used to having someone who is not Jordanian. More than 30% of the population are immigrants. So we got used to having other blood running in the country. Today I'm gonna talk about different traumas that I had not personally experienced or witnessed, though I personally have witnessed a lot of trauma and experience, but compared to the traumas that I have witnessed through my work, they are negligible because I cannot say that I had trauma when I was a fat little kid being bullied compared to someone who lost everything they relate to in life. I'm going to compare the trauma from Syrians that I worked with in Jordan, Syrians that I worked with in Syria, refugees that I worked with here in Australia, refugees and asylum seekers, trauma as us international aid workers when we are working with these traumatized people, that we have to help them because that's us as humans, that we have to support other human beings in the time of need. And also I'm going to talk about the trauma that a host country would have. Syrians in Syria, it is very interesting because the whole situation in Syria is traumatizing. Why? In Syria, before the war, you cannot, as a person, go and talk to a police officer and tell them you made a mistake, because it was under so much corruption that you cannot say that. You'll go to jail. Simple and easy. So imagine you, as a Syrian, living there, everything like excluded. Everything you can relate to is not relatable anymore. Syria was a very living in their own cocoon, living in their own isolation. But then when the war happened, it exploded everything. Nothing that we know of. My account with Syrians that were living in the refugee camps can be summarized to one of the following for this situation. I was in Syria doing my business as a logistics manager, and I saw a group of people coming. So when I say a group of people, they're just crossing a part of the desert, because that's where our refugee camp was. When I say refugee camp, we had between 18,000 to 22,000 people, plus minus, of course. So I saw a group of people coming. There was an elder woman, to another younger woman and little kids. So me thinking, because I'm Middle Eastern, so I understand how it works, probably it's a mother and her daughter, plus a sister, like their sister or a second wife, and the kids. And then I discovered that the only relation between them is that they were the only sole survivor of a one building that collapsed. So they all know each other because they were neighbors. They are not blood related. The trauma that I witnessed most or encountered were for children and women. Little men that were in the camp, because either they were shot dead or they were recruited or they were took to prisons. So the women and the children were the most traumatized people, mostly for children. As Seth said, I am a very positive person, and I always know that everything in life is a blessing and a lesson. Lesson that we cannot take anything for granted whatsoever. And I always tell people, the only granted thing in life is you are going to live it, but it will end. So you have to live it. The blessing that we had from the Syria situation is, for the very first time ever in a humanitarian aid missions around the world, we have special programs for the kids. In Syria, we had something called children-friendly spaces, where the children are allowed to be children. So there was a Play-Doh, and there were some crayons and papers, and there were this and that. That would help them a little bit with their trauma. We had a special program just for the psychological aid of these people, but mostly were women that they don't know what to do. The culture in the Middle East is the man is the head of the house, and he has to do everything. So imagine a woman that lost her husband, that she has to deal with that trauma, and of course she would have lost someone else from her life, family, friends, neighbors. So now she has to readapt herself, that I have to take care of my kids. And sometimes an elder relative. So that was a lot, there was a lot of traumatized issues there. Having said that, also that these people have lost everything they can relate to within the house or all of that. I have been traumatized also, because I had to deal with, so in order to keep my business going, when I say my business, putting all of these logistics things in place to help all of these people. I was there in 2013 when a chemical attack happened. So I was a bit traumatized, like, what should I do when I go to Syria? Do I inhale or do I not inhale? Like, what would happen to me? Because no one would tell you what's going on. But I was like, worst thing that can happen, that I will die. And I will die anyways. I had 6 hospitals that I had to ship them inside. But again, I will cause trauma to the Syrians because they had made in USA. Because of the traumatization that they had previously, they would never use them because they are American. So we had to scrap all the labels, relabel them, repack them, and all of that. I had to deal with people like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, whatever you want, other coalitions. And that causes another trauma, because those people are also traumatized because they are fighting someone from their own country and from their own blood. But they will be more traumatized if they don't. And then these people are like, yeah, I know someone who come from this city that is also joining these people, and they have to fight us. So, as you might label it, it's a very traumatized situation. Adding to that trauma, that these people always thinking, when this ends, the whole Syria situation, we have to rebuild. With what? There are no resources, there are no this and that. So that's another factor that we have to add to. Now that's the Syrians in Syria. The Syrians in Jordan, same, but a little bit less. The Syrians in Jordan, and I'm not because I am Jordanian, but Jordan, it was the first country to open their border without any restrictions. Meaning, we had no border control. Whomever wants to come to our country, they're extremely welcomed. For one of the many reasons of the origin of the Jordanians are Bedouins. And for a brief, for those who don't know Bedouins, you rock up to their tents because they live in tents in the desert. You rock up to their tent, they will host you for 3 continuous days without asking you what do you want, who are you, where you're coming from, and all of that. So hospitality. And that's us Jordanians. And most of the Middle Easterns, of course. But I can talk because I'm Jordanian and I live that camp in Jordan. The trauma that we had in Jordan is the Syrians coming to Jordan, they had their own trauma. But also us as Jordanians, we had the trauma because we are used to be for immigrants, because 30% of our population is immigrants since 1946. But also, we as a country, we have $1.15 billion of debt. So also when we want to take these extra people, that will cause extra trauma for us. So us as a Jordanian were a bit shaken because our economy was shaken. The security of the country was shaken because we have no clue. We don't vet people. Like whomever is going to come, they will come. So we don't vet them. What's helped a little bit, that Jordan is a very peaceful country. We don't have any issues with any other countries. So we have highest number of international organizations for a response aid that are in Jordan. But it's a little bit organized. Just going back to my notes. As international aid workers, it was very hard. It was daunting. Because you have to, I will not lie, it was very interesting. Because you are going and working for the sake of the conversation. David is a person who needs help, and I'm doing all the help that I can. But when I go back from work to home, I still keep thinking about the situation. There are situations that stick with you. One of them is a kid that continuously was crying and upset. And, excuse my French, I don't know any better word than, it shits me that this was happening to this kid and I cannot do anything. But for the kid, they were very upset because they lost their favorite toy. And that's what the kid can relate to. So we as international humanitarian aid workers, we always used to, of course we get the guidance, we get the psychological Skype sessions and all of that. But it's very hard. For me, it was very hard because I'm 15 minutes away from a war zone. We were talking yesterday, Steph and I. Steph Candy hosted me, and she was saying, "Oh, were you able to sleep because of the noise?" And I was like, "I was living in next to a war zone. So imagine every time there was a rocket, you would be awake." There were so many times that you get a phone call at 2 a.m., and then at 3 a.m., and then at 4 a.m., because there is something happening, and you can't help yourself getting upset, but then you are like, if I don't help them, it will not work. So I have to help them. That's why, for the greater good, and as a Rotarian, you'll be like, fine, it's okay. So Jordan and Syria, I have seen mostly in Syria, I've seen a lot of death, body parts, body holes, and all of that. So I decided I'm gonna leave all of this and come to Australia. Geographically very far from everything. No one knows me, no one will give me work, no one will give me anything. Well, I wish that was the situation. I was involved with the Australian Red Cross. Australian Red Cross does a lot of work with the refugees and asylum seekers. And the trauma that I have witnessed is a very new/old trauma, because the clients that we have, they had the trauma of displacement to start with. They are in a country that they don't speak the language. They are in a country that is totally different regulations and laws and all of that. Even for me, when I arrived to Australia, it was like, what do you mean I have to pay you $300 to change the bulb just because you have to be certified? No, I will not do that. I will do it myself. If I get electrocuted, it's fine. What do you mean I have to pay the government taxes that will be spent God knows how? But I also have to do superannuation and taxes and all of that. It was frustrating in the beginning, but then I got used to it. And that, with all love and respect to all the immigrants and refugees and asylum seekers, that I speak very good English. I would not say fluent. Very good English. I understand systems. I've worked with a lot of foreigners and all of that. So one case we had that I dealt with in Australia, in South Australia, in Adelaide. So when I arrived to Adelaide, so I'm an Adelaide Australian boy, don't hold it against me. I was working with someone who didn't get the problem was transportation. because they never got to use public transportation, because the country they came from didn't have public transportation. And she had a massive issue of getting into the tram, tap, leave, tap, and leave. Plus, she had an issue of going to the supermarket and do the shopping. That also causes her more trauma and more distress and all of that. So that's another account of trauma that we have noticed. Another one was the trauma that is of all of these wars around the world. These were wars around the world that is causing to everyone in the world. The other day we were counting how many issues are happening in the world, and we say issues doesn't account as a terrorist attack, let's say. Though it is a massive issue, but compared to someone who is having wars and all of that around the world. We ended up with 38 countries in the world that have massive issues. There are 44 or 46 million refugees, displacement, asylum seekers, and homeless people. When I say homeless, it's not within a country. It's people who were kicked out from the country. Now, all of this, I totally understand that this is happening and all of that. I bet some of you are asking, okay, we understand you have blabbering for 10 minutes. What do you want us to do? I don't have a solution. I would love to have a magic wand, one of these Harry Potter. There is no problems in the world. But I found it. I devoted my life that if I know someone has a problem, I would nag the shit out of them to talk to me about it, because I have recently lost a friend, took his own life, because there are things that were not happening. And when I say things are not happening, I say this with all love. It's a first world problem. Oh, I cannot find a job. My education is not working. My boss is not treating me well. We were talking together before the incident, and way before the incident. And I told him, well, at least you have to be thankful that you have a job, that you have money, that you are in a safe place. But I discovered it doesn't work. We have to do more. One of the many things that I can recommend is talk to each other. Don't judge each other. Us as Rotary, and as many of you would know, we have a lot of mental health. And today, we were listening about a new brilliant initiative about mental health that you can find all about it. I cannot recite everything that happened about it, but you can find everything about it, I imagine, at the website for the club or the newsletter. If you don't have the newsletter, sign up for the newsletter if you're not a charity. And you will know how you can help. Some people, they tell me, I am only one person, I cannot do anything. And I remind them that forests starts with one tree. When the birds are herding songs, it starts with one bird. I know one hand cannot clap, but one hand can pull you from down to up and help you. I will not share anymore because I think you got the idea. I think you got where we are and what I am hoping to do